I'm Ryan Jeffrey, and this is the Passionate About OSS podcast. The purpose of the podcast is to shine a light on some of the brilliant minds in the OSS and telco industry. We go in to describe some of their background, but also to share some of their knowledge, tips, and techniques. Today, we'll be taking a look at managing an OSS BSS in more of a mid-tier telco. Our guest today is a relative newcomer to OSS BSS. In 2017, he became Director of Info Systems and Business Analytics for an independent broadband provider in the state of Indiana in the USA. He quickly developed a love, or perhaps a love-hate relationship, with the OSS BSS tools he inherited responsibility for. He's been in telco for around 8 years, but followed a less common pathway to get there, as we'll soon discover. His questions have spawned many articles on the Passionate About OSS blog, probably more than anybody else. So I'm delighted to have him on the call because he's one of the most enthusiastic learners and thinkers about OSS BSS that I've met. Welcome to Stephen Cocciarella.
Thanks, Ryan. Happy to be on the podcast.
Delighted to have you on. So Stephen and I first met only relatively recently, back in 2019, when he was, and probably always seems to be, in discovery mode. He'd inherited the responsibility for an entire OSS BSS stack in his director role. We'll get to that in a little bit more detail later on, but do you remember much about that time when we first met and the problems you were looking to solve back then, Stephen?
Yeah, definitely. So at that time, it was around the time that I had concluded that we needed to make some major changes in the BSS OSS stack. And the problem that I was facing was the primary system that we were on was all from one vendor. It was this big, complex, kind of legacy monolithic system that made it really hard to make any one change because it wasn't really designed for swapping out one piece for another. And what I started to fall into was a little bit of paralysis from overanalysis almost, in that there was just so much to do, and I felt like I couldn't change one thing without changing everything. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I felt like I couldn't change much due to change management, mm-hmm. and just the pace of the organization. So I had reached out. I was on this kind of desperate search for a vendor-neutral consultant because, you know, every BSS OSS vendor that you contact will tell you that their software can solve all your problems and make you breakfast in the morning.
Yep.
But, you know, what I really wanted to do was talk to someone that could help me look at it independently. And that's how I found your blog. And that's how I reached out to you. And, you know, we didn't end up being able to get deep into that project, but it was still the beginning of a good relationship because, as you said, we've talked a lot since then.
Yeah. And was that your first role dealing directly with OSS BSS, or in your earlier roles as BA and support, had you interacted with them as well there?
Yes, definitely had interacted with them in all the roles at Smithville, just with different levels of responsibility, I guess you could say. So in the support role, I was effectively just an end user. Mm. We were switching from one BSS OSS to another, and as sometimes happens with these large projects, nobody really thought about the trouble ticketing side of things or the, you know, case management or any of those processes. And so basically they bought this new system and then said, oh, by the way, somebody needs to figure out how to do all of that. Mm. So I volunteered for the project of figuring out how we were going to kind of operate in this new system. And that's how I first got started really taking on a more active role in doing some of the configuration side of BSS OSS. And it was really just, at that point, basic trouble ticketing setup, you know, tracking the right data, you know, confirming the processes and procedures for moving work around between departments and things like that. So that was in the support role. I started to take on some other projects. You know, for example, network engineering wanted to pass down their tier one duties so that they could have more time to do engineering and less time answering calls from customers. So I took that project on, and that gave me a little bit more exposure to some of the network management side of BSS OSS stacks. You know, big picture, what happened at Smithville is that project got me noticed by HR, and they hired me to be an organizational development analyst. Mm. The point of that job really was go take a look at a department and figure out how you can make their jobs better. in a nutshell. And what I found out was that the chief complaint was always our processes are terrible.
Usability.
Yes, absolutely. So I really started to dig into that. And effectively, I, you know, my opinion is that there's a spectrum of, you know, kind of HR all the way to IT, which is, you don't normally hear those on one spectrum. But the way I see it, it's, you know, HR and then organizational development. And then in the middle is like a business analyst. Then you have like a business systems analyst. And then you have like developers and just core IT people. So maybe a non-traditional way of labeling that spectrum. But I basically told the Smithville leadership, I feel like my role is shifting away from HR stuff and more towards analytics, you know, process improvement. And they said, that's great. We want to make you a BA manager and go hire some staff. And in that role, I was doing a lot of process improvement. And my BSS OSS involvement there was really, how do I optimize this process within the constraints of what we currently have? And how do we set up what we currently have to best support our processes? So that was a lot of discovery, you know, reaching out to the vendor, how does this work? How do we set this up? You know, so I learned a lot about every aspect of our systems in that role.
And it's really interesting that you take that perspective. So again, it was a real persona driven perspective on things rather than less so on the technical perspective and more about the people and how they interact with it, which is somewhat novel, I find, in this industry. We tend to tackle it a bit more from the technical perspective, but I'm finding more and more that it's more around, as you talked about, the change management is often an afterthought on these projects, as opposed to that being really one of the driving forces behind them.
Yeah, in my experience, the change management and the people side of the project is typically more than half the work.
Yep.
It's more than half.
Yeah, I can attest to that too, having worked on some projects in the past where the solution had actually been technically perfect, but the people refused to use it. And that was because the appropriate change management mechanisms weren't put in place, the appropriate HR mechanisms weren't put in place. So it's a really interesting perspective that you came to. And so it's brilliant that you've had a background there in ops as well, a brilliant upbringing that gives you that real user perspective. But if we go back a little bit further, your career journey started a little bit differently than most in the OSS and telco space. Tell us a little bit about where your career started out and in the middle of the GFC, no less.
Sure. Yeah, I actually started out as a musician. So I went to school for music in high school, and growing up, I was always, you know, a talented musician. And it's one of those kind of ran in the family, I think. And partially it was what I wanted to do. And to be honest, partially I didn't really know what else I wanted to do. So I majored in music and I was good enough at it to make a living at it. I kind of worked freelance. I eventually got a job working on cruise ships as a musician. And that was a blast. And I actually have no regrets about the very curvy indirect path I took to get to where I am now. Because I have a lot of interesting, you know, experiences along the way. Cruise ships were amazing because I effectively got paid to travel the world. I couldn't even fathom doing that job now. I think it's a young person's job, and not that I'm not a young person anymore, but you know, you're untethered, right? You're literally floating around and figuratively floating around in life when you do that type of job. But the best thing that came out of that by far was I met my wife. Of course, then was just the girlfriend and then the fiance and then the wife. And that's actually why we ended up getting off ships primarily, was that after being fortunate enough to be together for several contracts back to back on the same ship, they changed the itinerary for our primary ship that we were on, and they were going to move her to Europe and me to Asia.
Long distance relationship.
Yes. And long distance relationship on top of having to rely on very expensive satellite phone cards, like $25 for 20 minutes expensive, and terrible internet on shared computers in a computer lab. That's being the only ways you have to communicate in completely different time zones too. So not a good recipe for a long-term relationship. So we both made the decision at that point that it was time for the next chapter. And my wife is from Mexico, but I don't speak Spanish. I mean, I understand a little bit. So the choice was pretty clear. She spoke excellent English, obviously still does. And so we landed in Indiana. So at least we would be close to one support network in my family. And not too long after that, I got the job at Smithville.
Fantastic. And clearly some other chapters have developed based on some of the background noise that's coming through. You've got a couple of little ones there.
That's right. And I've tried all sorts of ways to get rid of that background noise, but I think I need to build a bunker or maybe get a second house or I don't know what. But yes, there are two children. I've got a 7-year-old and a 4.5-month-old.
So exciting time. So thanks for dropping in on the call, considering.
Yeah. So hey, Ryan, I wanted to touch base regarding the BSSOS's kind of experience at Smithville. I didn't really get into the last role, the IS director.
Yeah.
The last part of that chapter, just to finish that story before we move on, was that when I was a BA manager focusing on process improvement, what I really started to find was that the root cause behind a lot of that was that the systems were inadequate. So I started to take on an increasingly technical role.
Mm.
But earlier you noted how I kind of came at the problem from like a human perspective, then a process perspective, and ultimately arrived at that system perspective. And I think that's a really astute observation.
A really important flow too, because often we start at step three in that process. So I think the fact that it really dawned on you quite early that it was a 1-2-3 process is quite important to call out. It's interesting, actually. So talking about the musical background, there are many OSS experts that I've come across who have got a real passion for music and play an array of different instruments on the side. But you're really only the second one I've known who started out a musician. The other one happened to be an amazing classical guitarist, but equally talented on mediation device driver development. Do you see any parallels or crossover skills really between music and telco software?
You know, I feel like a lot of people ask that question or questions like that. Honestly, I don't think so. I think maybe there's some underlying characteristics or traits that make people more likely to be a good musician that also make you more likely to be successful in a lot of other ventures in life. But I don't think there's a causal relationship between directly being a musician and, you know, BSSOS success or other software related. I guess you could say some of the things like probably more skills developed by being a musician are things like dealing with stage fright, for example. I was never, ever afraid to open my mouth. So at Smithville, even when I was just this young guy that was new to the industry, I was never afraid to raise my hand. I would ask the president of the company something when everyone else was too afraid to even say anything. And I think a lot of that goes back to, since I was young, I've been put on stage to perform in front of people. And if you can do that, then you've got nerves of steel and you can talk to anyone. So I think that helps a lot. Another one probably is just being able to improvise, like being the classical musician and then later a jazz musician, really getting into improvisation. I think that helps a lot with creativity and being able to move from one topic to the next quickly.
Yeah. And so from the cruise ships and being a musician on the cruise ships to telco, what brought that transition about? Did you always have an interest in technology, or that was the opportunity that came up when you landed back in Indiana?
Well, I think I've always liked technology. I played a lot of video games growing up, probably like me and a million other people. I remember configuring the TCP/IP settings to get Quake 1 to work with my, you know, two streets over neighbor that played the game too.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess you could say that was interesting to me. And then just technology in general, my father owns his own business and started off as a photographer and then moved into kind of graphic design and eventually web development. And he's a full stack developer, kind of wears a lot of different hats. So I think technology kind of runs in the family too.
Mm. And that artistic, creative technology intersect, I guess, is quite interesting. And I do find that quite common across OSS people as well.
That's really strange. But yeah, I believe you.
So you then made a rapid rise in Smithville. You went from tech support specialist or organizational development analyst, business analyst. So then you moved on to, even though you're no longer at Smithville, are you able to tell us a little bit about Smithville themselves, with the scope, the size, product, services, their offerings? And then that will lead us in towards the the next phase of the discussion around your role as a director there at Smithville.
Yeah, so I would characterize Smithville as a big little company. They're small in the sense of the grand scheme of the telco world. They're a very small drop in a very large bucket. But, you know, they're one of the larger employers in the area. And for a company the size, I think it's around 200 employees now, you know, we had a lot of product and service offerings. You know, the company had multiple operating divisions. We had, you know, we offered, you know, fiber to the home. We offered enterprise, you know, internet access and transport grade fiber, you know, up to 100 gigabit per second transport. We were starting to get into some more advanced networking there. And then, you know, we offered other products too. We had the traditional copper network. We had all of the traditional phone service, both over copper and fiber. And we also had some kind of other side services like home security, video conferencing, just all these little add-ons that, you know, I'm sure larger telecoms have them too. But for a company our size, without the ability to spin up entire departments to specialize in things, that became one of the big challenges, was how to use this highly functional management-minded org structure and how to have all these different product focuses running concurrently. So that's why I call it a big little company.
And it's a really interesting perspective, because one of the things I often talk about within OSS BSS is one of the challenges we face is having a really big variant tree. And part of that is driven by the number of services, and particularly for a medium-sized company to be able to handle that breadth of service offerings is, and the challenge that that poses to the OSS and everything related to it. So people who are developing and testing and the contact centers and everything else flows out from the complexity of the service map. Do you think that's because being a rural telco provider that you have to provide those services for the people in the region? You have to get out there and provide more services than if you were that mid-tier type telco in a city market. You may just specialize in just doing ISP type services, but the fact that you have broadened into things like home security, is that just the nature of being a rural telco?
You know, I think that being able to offer every gamut of communications technology is a very natural outgrowth of being a rural provider, because there's just really not many other options. You know, if you were a major hospital, for example, and you were in charge of procurement and getting an internet connection set up, you'd probably want to go with a big, well-established name. But if you're in the middle of nowhere, Indiana, and you're 1 mile away or half a mile away from fiber that can deliver you rock solid service, you might be willing to go with this smaller provider. So I think that's how we ended up getting into all these enterprise markets, was just that, you know, we were the best option for a lot of them. And that's really true. Like I'd say that the level of customer service and the reliability of the network was always very high. So we were hitting a lot higher than our weight class in terms of our capabilities to deliver.
And obviously very trusted by the community.
Yes. And Darby, the CEO, did a lot of community involvement and was a major kind of donor behind a lot of charities in the area. So I think that probably helped with kind of community awareness too.
And you stepped into that role as Director of Information Service and Data Analytics. That role is really not to be underestimated either, because if I'm not mistaken, you looked after the full stack OSS BSS. You looked after the digital transformation, IT infrastructure, data science, process re-engineering. Is there anything else I really missed amongst that? Because not only is it a really big and wide service stack, but a big and wide-ranging role that you stepped into as well.
Yeah, so I would say all that's accurate, except for the IT infrastructure. There was actually a different team that took care of most of the infrastructure related. So all the enterprise data systems, BSS, OSS, ERP, to a lesser extent, some of the other ones, you know, field service management, anything that would tangentially touch customer data. And you're absolutely right. Process reengineering, the business intelligence or, you know, data analytics side of things. Yeah, it was definitely a big role. I think that I would describe how I got there primarily as like the vacuum theory. There was nobody else doing it, so I gravitated towards the vacuum.
That's a really fascinating perspective too. I really love that. And probably a great suggestion for people starting out in OSS and who are ambitious as well. Is I found the same. Working in small teams meant that there were more vacuums. So working on a major tier one OSS implementation with a team of 10 meant there were more vacuums than working in a big telco where you've got 100 other people in the OSS space, and therefore you become a little bit more pigeonholed. So I really like the vacuum theory there, Stephen.
Yeah, it worked out well for me too. I think I had this kind of insatiable desire to do more and learn more. Mm. You know, I was always the type that, you know, sometimes to my own detriment, taking on too much, but, you know, always trying to learn new things. And I think that served me well there.
Mm. And it's definitely a trait of the highest achiever OSS people that I've met, is just that inquisitiveness and the willingness to look beyond the tech, look beyond their pigeonhole and see where it fits in the broader scheme of things. And I think that's something that comes through clearly in our conversations. You have a huge inquisitiveness and way beyond just the technology. And also when I talked earlier about a full stack OSS, what were the most important features and functions that you really had to cover for the stakeholders?
Well, I mean, I guess the most important thing that the business would just shut down if it didn't work is billing. Mm-hmm. And I had a really talented team, you know, kind of two primary applications admin and a really talented billing administrator / business analyst, and that they were really, really good at what they did. And they knew a lot about kind of this big gnarly legacy system that we were stuck on. So that was the area that, you know, if billing doesn't work, the revenue doesn't come in, mm. and then the business is done, right? Mm. So that's a big important one. But in terms of just operational, you know, obviously the automatic provisioning in terms of time savings is huge. Mm. And it's one of the more technically complex areas. The general like revenue assurance tasks was another big one that we saved a lot of time and money for the company on. But I think the area that I ended up spending a lot of time on unexpectedly at first was the process management, you know, orchestrating how to complete an order. Mm. So that actually ended up being a pretty big time consumer as well.
Mm. And also, I guess you crossed into inventory assurance, workforce management, all those other really key aspects of running the operational teams for Smithville.
Yes. So definitely, I think the other kind of big systems that we really got into, you know, CRM, we mm. started up using Salesforce, and that's a whole other fun story that I could get into.
And I'm sure we will a little bit later on.
Yes, I have a lot to say on that topic. And then Click Software, you probably know, mm. is a kind of, they were actually acquired by Salesforce not too long ago.
Indeed.
And using them as a field service management. And then just standing up the overall business intelligence approach, really before we started on it, it was just kind of legacy Crystal reports that would spit out a spreadsheet. And this is probably a story as old as time, really. But, you know, what you end up with is 10 different reports going to 10 different mid-level people, mm. being transformed formulas, copy-pasting, and then getting sent to various executives. And then them doing similar combining of each other's reports, mm. and doing more manipulation. And then they end up on the president's desk and he says, why do the numbers not match? Mm. Well, because 1,000 hands touched it after it came out of the system. And the question that was asked wasn't even the right question. So what I set out to do with the business intelligence side, and again, I have a lot of people to thank on this because I had a really talented business analyst who was completely integral into setting all of this up. But we stood up like a data warehouse and kind of repeatable automated ETL processes. And we stood up Power BI as an analytics platform and really started to build out these analytic dashboards with the goal of, you know, here's this data set, use it. Use these interactive dashboards to answer any question, even questions you didn't know you had, mm. which is a completely different, it's a paradigm shift from the traditional ask a question, pull out a static data sample, right? It's much more dynamic than that online analytic processing approach.
Mm. And become incredibly valuable to a lot of people in there. So it's taking it out of the realm of just operations and putting it in the hands of the execs, putting it in the hands of marketing to go and do their job and all the other pieces that would really drive particularly a rural telco.
Yeah, it definitely did eventually become really, really important. And new president came in and he was a big proponent of BI as a company-wide mm. initiative. So that helped a lot too. Yeah. And then with all of the integrations, we also stood up an integration platform, which I found to be a really interesting discipline, kind of that hub and spoke model. And that really got me thinking of, hey, wouldn't it be great someday to move to an OSS BSS stack that's, you know, more kind of best of breed, where we can swap in and out components if we don't like the way something works, rather than this just giant monolithic system.
Mm.
And that's around the time I started talking to you.
Mm.
And clearly from what we've talked about, when you combine the product mix with all of those responsibilities, with all of the technical coverage, it's an incredibly broad estate. Did you enjoy the challenge of wearing those multiple hats? If so, what did you enjoy, and maybe what were the things you didn't enjoy so much?
I definitely liked the variety and the breadth of responsibility.
Mm.
I guess the only challenges really is, you know, it's a small company. A lot of times the systems kind of took a backseat in terms of budget, executive attention, things like that. So I think the only frustrating part was being saddled with kind of a bunch of legacy systems that nobody had really put any thought into for years. Mm. Was that I became frustrated that I had to say no a lot. You know, someone would say, hey, we want to do this thing, this reasonable thing that any company in the year 2017 or, you know, 2018 or whatever it was should do.
Mm.
And I would be the guy that said, I'm sorry, we can't do that because we don't even have basic APIs.
Mm.
So that was the frustrating part, was the technology limitations and the fact that the organization at times wasn't willing to do what it took to move beyond those. But that's a tough pill to swallow, right? That's not easy for any company to do.
Yeah.
But I did enjoy definitely the breadth of technology.
And it feels to me that almost all mid-tiers will have that same challenge. They've got a huge scope and services to cover, but without the resources at their disposal of the tier ones do. Do you think that your experience with the mid-tier at Smithville tends to also reflect that others are very constrained in that market as well, constrained for resources like people and budgets and even attention perhaps?
Yes, I think so. I definitely think that in that market there tends to be, you know, you're not going to find a company Smithville size that has an army of solution engineers that can build a bunch of custom integrations and spin up their own kind of intricate BSS OSS stack. So what you end up seeing is this handful of companies that have these kind of all-in-one systems that do everything from billing to provisioning to captive network inventory within their tool, mm-hmm. to kind of the ERP, accounting, HRIS. You know, you have these huge systems that try to do everything, and they're attractive to a company that's a small rural company in the sense that it's not really realistic for that type of company to build something complex with a best of breed approach typically.
Yeah.
So they kind of are forced to use these, and there's not really many of these offerings out there. And in fact, I would be willing to bet you'd probably never heard of some of them.
Yeah. Well, that's the really interesting thing. So in my vendor directory, there's around 450 listings. So to me, it kind of implies that there are a lot of vendors out there that serve the mid-tier, but a lot that are completely unknown. And I'd imagine that you would have come across quite a lot, but I should say that generally speaking, they haven't quite nailed it for that mid-market as a collective, have they? So there might be some that are really specifically designed for a certain group or a certain customer, but I guess from what you're saying, you never really found that silver bullet, the perfect ideal solution. Out of those 450 vendors, there's not one that provides the perfect solution for what you needed and what many of the mid-tier market needed.
Well, I think there's some underlying problems that made it hard to know if any of them were even a good fit. And part of it, like I mentioned before, that paralysis by over-analysis, there were so many options, and I felt like, you know, here's an example. If you can't bill unless you enter the order in a system, and you can't enter the order only through their user interface, there's no APIs, then effectively you can't move just billing, or you can't move just order orchestration and entry. You have to move all of that all at once. Oh, and by the way, you also have to move all of your provisioning. Oh, and by the way, your network inventory is captive within this solution. So that's why I was so paralyzed. And trying to evaluate these other solutions, and you know, based on the million questions that I ask you over time, is coming from a small rural provider, I was just blown away by the terminology, the complexity, the just sheer scale of some of these other solutions. You know, you and I would talk about translating a customer-facing service to a resource-facing service. And I didn't even know what that meant at first. I had to ask you a bunch of questions that turned into blog entries before I even could have an intelligent conversation with you. And I think that's part of the challenge is some of these smaller vendors that cater to these kind of rural, you know, mid-tier telcos, they don't really adhere to any standards, it seems. They kind of just do things their own way. So that made it really hard to evaluate. And also just a lot of the bigger companies wouldn't really give a company Smithville size the time of day. So the bigger players, they know that they're too expensive for you. And the, yeah, so it's a tough position to be in. There are some shining stars. I think there's a, you know, I'm a fan of Canvio. I think they're doing really great work of, as a service for kind of companies Smithville size and a little larger too. And I think Inexo, built on the Salesforce platform, is another exciting one. There's definitely some options coming up.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you were to put yourselves in the shoes of an exec at a mid-tier, and knowing that there are all these constraints on budget, would you also see the OSSBS as a cost center that, and therefore you do need to constrain resources on? Or would you, now knowing what you do, take a different perspective on how to pitch an OSSBS, how to justify a potential expense on that? Or would you still follow the way that the execs tend to see these solutions as just cost centers?
Yeah, I think I'm vehemently opposed to the idea of treating any kind of digital transformation, in particular OSSBS, as a cost center, because I think that stifles innovation. My viewpoint is this is the system that you literally use to run your business. I mean, like every penny that comes to your bottom line goes through your OSSBS, right? Mm. Every order that comes in, every customer interaction gets tracked there, right? It's a huge, hugely important thing. So not just in terms of use it to increase your revenue, but you can also use OSSBS to decrease your costs. Mm. There's, in my opinion, very little in the telecom industry that's more important in terms of your bottom line than a good, well-functioning OSSBS. I feel like, you know, if upper management doesn't see that or understand it, that's a problem. And the other main problem I feel like, and this might be just my experience, but I have a feeling it's something that anyone working for a kind of rural, smaller company would find, is that even the staff and other middle management are very change averse. So digital transformation, despite the huge technical hurdles I described before, there's even bigger cultural hurdles.
Yeah, and I suspect that goes beyond not just the rural telcos as well. I suspect that's entrenched in a lot of telcos. An interesting perspective, because I also take the view of, having seen good OSS and then not so good OSS, the difference in efficiency, and you talked about bottom line, and the efficiency in being able to do things drives top and bottom line, in my opinion, because if you're doing something really effectively, then customers are going to have a higher appreciation. If your processes and systems are so cumbersome that you're getting fallouts, that you're getting a long time before a service is ready for service for a customer, then you're obviously going to get less customer support. It's a really interesting perspective that they are still seen as a cost center. So I'm glad that you've taken that perspective. Do you think it's a challenge still? Do you think it is a reflection that many execs do still see it as a cost center, or from other people that you've spoken to in that mid-market space?
Yeah, I think it's in general something that you'd see at a lot of companies in that mid-market space, that it's treated like a cost center. You know, a lot of them even like don't have CIOs, or perhaps the kind of billing system is under a CFO. Like they truly just control it as a cost and nothing more. So yeah, I think that's a pretty systemic issue. And you're absolutely right about what you said and how it affects revenue. I mean, and on top of that, people are demanding modern digital experiences. You can go to SpaceX and order a rocket launch online, right? I mean, maybe that's a little bit exaggerated, but, you know, you can do so much just from the click of a button on your smartphone these days, that the fact that it's so hard to interact with a telecom that doesn't have automated processes. You know, if you don't have zero touch end to end, e-commerce all the way to delivery, then you're behind the times. And I feel like that's due to the technological constraints of some of these smaller telecoms. That's just where they are. And I fear that they're going to fall behind the times.
Yeah, and I guess it's also the hyperscalers are driving expectations now too, that you can just self-serve, you can do it online. It's all up at the touch of a button. You're not waiting around for somebody to respond to a phone call and things like that. So, I think the bar's being set increasingly high. And, yeah, it will be interesting to see the likes of Starlink and Kuiper as they come in, how much of an impact that will have, and particularly for the mid-markets who aren't able to change and adapt to those disruptions. Do you feel the same?
I do, more so about this newest kind of satellite iteration, more so than I did about 5G. With 5G, I actually was one of the people that viewed it as an opportunity for carriers like Smithfield, because I said, hey, you know, they're going to want to build towers. We've got fiber. We can be an infrastructure provider. There's nothing wrong with making money on that side of the equation. But with satellite, for a company like Smithfield, I feel like that's, you know, a potential disruptor. You know, you didn't mention it, but another kind of disruptor, and this may be just kind of a quirk of the U.S. kind of funding model for telecom, is that I feel like electric cooperatives are really starting to get into running fiber. And if you think about it, they've got the poles, and, you know, leasing that infrastructure is expensive. And but they get, you know, funding to build that, and they're well funded. And if you're going to run electrical wires, it's not that much more expensive to run some fiber along with them. Or if you're trenching, you know, many thousands of feet, or, you know, doing directional boring to run electrical wires, it's not that much more expensive to go ahead and throw in some conduit and some fiber too. So what a lot of these companies have realized is, hey, we can build out all these assets fairly cheap. Now we just need to start managing a network. And I think a lot of these electric companies are cooperatives that are non-for-profit too. So they can really price aggressively and low. And I feel like that's another major threat to the kind of small, privately owned rural telecoms.
Yeah, brilliant insight. So I know you spend a lot of time speaking with other people external to Smithfield, so vendors, outsiders like me. Did you really come to any realizations about how the mid-market OSS BSS could or should be done better, whether that's either by the vendors, the carriers, or even some of the external disruptors that we talked briefly about?
Yeah, I'd say the main finding is there isn't really much of a focus on a mid-tier offering. It seems like there's really, really big offerings and then really, really bad kind of small offerings and not much in the middle. It seems like there's this awkward, it's kind of like a teenager that's in an awkward growth spurt or something, but a company that's just big enough and just complex enough to not fit into one of the smaller simpler systems, but not big enough and not savvy enough to be able to string together and integrate and buy and select and build an OSS stack of their own. There's that awkward in-between size and stage that I think Smithfield is in, and probably a lot of other companies. And I didn't see many compelling offerings catering to that space.
Yeah, that's really, really interesting. I'm assuming that within your role, it would have really been a case of drinking from the fire hose. And assuming that's true, did you develop any techniques on how to prioritize, particularly because you had the relatively monolithic OSS BSS, that it was hard to break things apart and move them around? You had any, I imagine, like everybody else in the OSS industry, you've got the infinite to-do list that you're working on. Did you figure out any techniques on how to help prioritize or how to break things apart so that you could get some movement happening? Maybe that's change management, maybe that's technology, maybe it's process.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, in terms of overall kind of prioritization, all other factors being equal, you know, there's some kind of hard and fast rules that you can use, you know, prioritizing things that increase revenue or decrease costs, things that improve the customer experience. I mean, those are kind of obvious, easy ones, but it's, you know, it's part art and part science, I think. In terms of techniques, when you've got this Gordian knot that's seemingly impossible to tackle, the CTO at Smithfield is a doctorate in systems engineering, really smart guy. And one of the things that he instilled on me is this kind of philosophy of just the power of small wins. And he would always say, cut it off and kill it. Meaning just, it doesn't matter if it's not the best thing that you should tackle, but if it's severable. Sever it. So, you know, an example is, well, field service may not be the most important thing to the organization, but it's relatively severable in the sense that I can move that out of where it currently is and I can integrate it, and there are just enough APIs to squeak by. Let's go ahead and sever that, cut it off and kill it, get us off one legacy platform, reduce some technical debt, incur some new technical debt, quite possibly. But at least you cut one thing off and kill it.
So taking that perspective of making it modular, not tying it back into the big monolith.
Exactly. And just kind of trying to stay agile like that, right? Like it's not going to be possible to fix everything all at once. And you just have to start finding ways to sever things and do them.
And we'll come back a little bit to some of those projects that you did work on. But you're now working with Growth Heroes. Can you tell us a little bit about them and your role there?
Yeah. So Growth Heroes is this kind of boutique consultancy that's centered around Salesforce. And I'm thoroughly enjoying myself here. I actually feel like I'm just as much drinking the fire hose now, maybe even more than ever. I would say the talent level here is just extremely high. Like I have really, really good coworkers that are, you know, rock solid. They're really knowledgeable. They're really good at what they do. The skill level is high. And the CEO and the owner, Jim, is just brilliant. And he's been a pleasure to work for. I think what I like about it the most so far is the kind of balance of getting to learn new things and having autonomy, but also having peers that I can rely on for architecture peer review. I want to say, hey, how would you guys architect a data structure that meets this requirement set? You know, I have a bunch of really smart people that I can talk to and get opinions on that.
It's one of the things that I was always big on is I always knew that my way is not necessarily the best way. And there's so many smart people out there to ask, bounce ideas off and refine the solution. Working in consultancy back in the early 2000s, I found that many of my colleagues would just figure out the solution by themselves. It was quite a singular pursuit in the way that they tackled consultancy. And I've seen it a bit in the OSS industry as well, but really interesting that you take a more collaborative approach. And I feel like you're probably going to give a better outcome for the customer at the end of it by taking in other people's opinions, particularly when you're surrounded by the really smart people you are.
Yeah, and I think one of the advantages is that it's a relatively small company and we communicate a lot. I feel like it's the nature of the beast in consultancy, and I'm very new to being a consultant, but my impression is, you know, when you're working for a company, you get to deeply know everything about that, all of the processes, all of the personas, every single stakeholder, every single business priority, right? You know it. You even know where the bodies are buried, right? But when you're working as a consultant, it's always outside in, and you don't have nearly that much visibility. But what little context you have is almost always very necessary to complete the tasks. So I feel like that's probably why you would see one consultant just do the work, is because they had the context, or at least they felt like they were the only one that knew that they required variables to complete the work. But you know, being on a smaller team, and Jim's really good about, for example, hey, this thing that you're going to build, this other consultant has built something just like that in the past couple of months. Why don't you talk to them about that? And that's proven to be really effective. I think that being kind of a smaller boutique firm helps with that.
It's one of the things I find really interesting about consultancy too, because you're always dealing with other people who have got more tribal knowledge. So you have to be really humble to say, well, they do have that knowledge that is incredibly valuable. I can't just walk in and say, this is the way it has to be done, because you do have to take on board so much of that tribal knowledge that they've developed over 5 years, 10 years, 30 years in some cases. There's no way you can replace on a consultancy first week in.
Yeah, and it's really nice to have someone that knows the business. But it's also nice because, generally speaking, if they're paying a consultant, that's because they know they need help. So I found that they're really open. And at Growth Heroes, we try to establish like these longer term relationships. You know, it's actually quite amazing. I was remarking to Jim, the owner, the other day, that I just spent quite a bit of effort in talking the customer out of doing a big chunk of work. And you won't see that everywhere. I think there's plenty of consulting firms that would be very glad to say, oh yeah, it's a big chunk of billable hours, we're going to go and do that and send them a big bill. And instead, we're kind of more of a model of like, we're going to try to talk you out of that because that's not what's best for your business. And what that ends up doing is like, we do well when they do well. And we end up on these kind of longer term relationships where they become these trusted advisor. It's not just Kern and Lynch and Salesforce, but we're actually like kind of strategic you know, business partners with them. And it's been really enjoyable to kind of be in that position.
Hmm. So you talked a little bit about the customers. Who are the ideal customers and what makes them come to you?
You know, that's funny. We were just having that conversation internally. I think the best customers are the ones that, you know, you have some level of access to decision makers so that you're not stuck in, you know, decision by committee purgatory, but also just, you know, someone that knows they need help and has somewhat of a vision of where they want to go. That's all those, you know, ingredients you can make a pretty nice recipe out of.
Mm. And with Growth Heroes, you mentioned that you were working really closely or predominantly with Salesforce type solutions. I believe you're a really big advocate of Salesforce being a great platform to build the OSSBSS of the future as well. Are you able to explain why you think that way?
Well, I think first off, if you just look analytically at what is typically considered part of the CRM discipline and information system domain versus what's in a BSS, there's a lot of overlap. And yeah, of course, you know, like an order for buying a product and shipping it to someone's house is very different than an order with an orchestration plan and provisioning, right? But effectively, there's a lot of overlap. It's just you extend certain areas. And then a lot of it's just the in general platform capabilities that I find really enjoyable. I guess I could put it this way, with basically just no budget and just me, I was able to build a lot of really, really cool stuff that helps Smithville a lot in Salesforce. Mm. And you know, now I'm a consultant and I get to build really cool solutions for people all day, every day. And it's just this kind of low code, no code platform that just allows very, very rapid innovation, rapid solution.
Are you able to tell us a little bit about some of the concepts? So without giving away too much of the detail about the projects you worked on at Smithville, at a high level, what kind of things did you work on using Salesforce that was helpful to Smithville?
Well, how I got into that's kind of funny. So at the time, the president of the company said, we need to take a look at this Salesforce environment that we have. And I said, yeah, sure, I'll do a quick analysis. And it was kind of off my radar. At the time, it was really just this thing that sales used. And nobody else really touched it. And when an order came in, they would literally just email stuff to an order entry person in another department. It was very isolated. It wasn't even on my radar. And I started to get into it. It was back when I was VA manager. And it was pretty bad, like the way it was set up. You know, even a great system can be bad if set up poorly. So, you know, at the time, I came back to this kind of committee that had the president and a few other kind of executive stakeholders, and I gave some recommendations and I said, you know, we can hire a partner, we can hire a consulting firm, we can, you know, maybe hire a FTE that specializes in this, but this is a lot to take on. And the president said, I want you to see what you can do, Stephen. And being the fool that I was, I said, okay, I guess I'll see what I can do.
Yeah.
So I naively dove in to trying to learn one of the biggest, most complex systems out there, and ended up really liking it.
Mm.
And so basically right away, I determined we needed to re-implement. Mm. So we worked to re-implement, and we worked with one of our billing system vendors who helped with the implementation to some extent, but mostly like the overall architecture was on us, and the training, the change management was all on us. They helped with that kind of basic org setup. So the first project was just moving everything over. And that was a massive ETL project, restructuring. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just forklifting the data. It was completely restructuring everything and making
it. It always seems to be the case, right?
Yes. Yes. That's the universal constant. And then like right off the bat, I had noticed that the Salesforce environment was being used primarily for costing custom jobs. So in an enterprise space, you're typically going to be running fiber out to someone that has no infrastructure. And you need to do all these complex return on investment, internal rate of return type calculations. And you need to gather detailed cost analysis before you even make a bid to the customer.
Mm.
And I had observed, you know, before I did this implementation plan, I did a deep dive into the processes. So we spent weeks just process mapping. And it was a horrendous process. You know, there was spreadsheets and PDFs and copy pasting left and right, no key controls. It was bad. So we implemented this system that was end to end, basically all the way from a new prospect coming to the system, going through a sales process, going through a cost estimation process where all of the engineers could use Salesforce to select different parts and assembly units that would be used. And those would get automatically totaled up, and the cost would get allocated based on rules from finance to services and infrastructure locations. And we could detect and calculate all of the financial measures that they wanted. And we could do controls like approval processes and say, you're allowed to sell it at this price or not this price. And that, you know, that kind of end-to-end approach where everything was in the system and everything had a data trail, everything was auditable and the math was visible end-to-end. It was great. And it got a lot of support from the right people. But I'll tell you who didn't like it was sales. Because they were accustomed to basically having a CRM where they could just type whatever they wanted. They could say, I'm selling my office chair for $5. There was no controls. But they came around eventually. I was going to say that was the big kind of first project we did in Salesforce.
It sounds to me like there were a lot of touch points into the OSS BSS. Would it be fair to say that that was almost like a flexible wrapper that you put around a relatively inflexible OSS BSS engine?
Yeah, absolutely. The way I put it to my team when I was trying to sell them on the value of this, and they bought on too eventually, was that once you get your data into Salesforce, you've effectively liberated your data. So, you know, we brought in this data and a lot of the key fields were read only, but you can still do stuff with them. You can do formulas and calculations. You can reference that data in other places. So an example, part of that same end-to-end chain that I was describing before, we built a custom contract lifecycle management solution. And it tied in with all of the billing agreements in the billing system. So we synced down the billing system, you know, agreements, which was basically just every service that someone had bought. And we would directly link those to contract line items. And we were able to use that integration point to determine whether someone was in contract or out of contract, but still active and therefore billing month to month or early terminated or canceled. You know, we could automatically determine the status of each and every contract line item across thousands of contracts just by having that data in Salesforce and building a couple simple formulas.
And effectively put it in your control rather than having to send a change request off to a vendor that might take 6 months and X amount of dollars. You could really control it and have a fairly rapid response to being able to implement that functionality.
Yep, that's exactly right. And it kind of snowballs from there, right? The more data you get in there, the more liberated it is and the more functionality you can bring in.
And the more questions you can ask of it and cross-link it and so forth.
Yeah, I really think that like the how easy it is to build process automation and business logic in Salesforce and how you can layer multiple layers of that on top of itself, it just makes it so incredibly scalable. Being able to spin up entire custom data structures with a couple clicks of a button is incredible to me. I just haven't seen anything else quite like it. It's that easy to use.
Based on that experience, is there anything in particular that you think we should take a leaf out of Salesforce's book on how to do things significantly better, significantly different?
You know, I think for the OSS, BSS kind of world, one of the problems I think that I've observed is there's like not much standardization. There's TM Forum and there's, you know, there's efforts, but like every vendor kind of has their own way of doing things. And I think one of the reasons why Salesforce is so successful is this concept of like having a standard object model that every org comes with. And you don't have to use it, right? You can literally use none of it or you can use all of it. Most customers end up using a mix of like custom and standard schema. But, you know, effectively what that means is if every Salesforce org has, you know, accounts and contacts and opportunities and leads and, you know, these standard objects that are laid out the same, related the same, have the same fields on them. Of course, you can add your own, right? You can build other objects and relate them however you want. But having that solid core of standard functionality is what has allowed their app ecosystem to thrive. So, you know, you could go out there and write an app and you could, instead of having to do a custom one-off integration for every single customer, they just install it. It just works. You know, so take, for example, if you were running a ticketing system in a traditional OSS stack and you wanted to be able to offer video chat support, let's just say, you'd have to like buy something and do a custom integration. In Salesforce, you just download something, click install, and you pay for it, and you've got it.
And so, I guess it's that partner network that's on the platform that adds a lot of value, that we don't really have anything similar within the OSS industry.
Right. I think so.
Yes, we're getting pretty close to the end here. I know that you learned a hell of a lot in your role in as the director of IS at Smithville. If you could go back to when you started, knowing what you know now and providing some mentorship back to yourself of those 4 years earlier or thereabouts, are there any particular insights, methodologies, connections that you would give to yourself, that you would mentor yourself on?
Well, I'd like to say, you know, especially since I'm on this podcast, I would probably, future me would write a note to pass me saying, hey, Paul Ryan.
He'll get you down. He'll confuse back. You more.
Well, you know, that did happen at first, but it needed to happen, right? Because I needed to learn the lingo. But yeah, I think key insights, I think that over time, I really learned to embrace that more agile approach and the kind of cut it off and kill it thing that I described before. Mm-hmm. And that's always easier said than done. But if I could have gotten started down that path sooner, I think it would have benefited me.
And also, I think the Agile Manifesto was a real eye-opener for me too, that delivering business value on a regular basis, but even thinking about how to break things down to deliver business value on a regular basis, not just a big bang a year and a half from now, was really important.
Yeah, absolutely. The other kind of key thing that I wish I'd learned earlier in my career, and this goes back to, you know, previously we were talking about like the human element of the project and how the change management is so important. This is definitely an oversimplification, but I'll never forget it because it fits so nicely with my experience. What I learned is that the formula for project success is the quality of the idea multiplied by the stakeholder buy-in. Super simple, right? So effectively what that means is you can have a 10 out of 10 idea, most brilliantly and elegantly designed system ever. But if nobody understands it but you, or nobody wants it, or nobody asked for it, it's going to fall flat and it's going to be an abject failure. Maybe you have a mediocre idea that's got incredible buy-in that everyone's rallying behind. That's going to succeed. And I wish I'd learned that sooner because I had failed projects that were awesome ideas that went nowhere because nobody understood them.
This podcast, the idea of it is to shine a light on the 360 degree view of people who touch OSS. And one of the things that, as engineers, we sometimes think of salespeople like the sleazy used car salesperson. But to me, it's around the persuasion, but also listening closely enough to package up a concept that people really buy into, people get excited about. And if they can get excited about it, the money and projects will tend to follow. And so that concept of persuasion, but also solving problems for customers, is something that I'm really, really big on as well. So it's interesting that call out that you make there too, about you can have a perfect, brilliant technical idea, but if nobody buys in, then it's just not going to fly. They'll go back to their spreadsheets.
Yes, they understand the spreadsheets, even if it's the worst idea ever. And that's actually feeds into the incremental design too, right? Like, you start with something simple that's a little bit more familiar, even if it's not the most elegant solution, and you gradually change them.
And in fact, that's probably a really good point too, is I think we can tend to overcomplexify things in the industry instead of trying to make it as simple as possible. You're more likely to get buy-in. You're more likely to be able to deliver something that's simple, but I know that's a bit ambitious too in some cases, because we are dealing with a really complex subject matter as well.
Yes, definitely. If you can find a simple pilot or MVP that, you know, gets some kind of good ROI for the customer, great, you know, do it.
Well, and even just getting momentum. I really feel that momentum is such a key thing, particularly when we're talking monoliths.
Absolutely. Yeah, that morale, internal stakeholders, buying in, seeing that momentum, that's huge.
So any final pearls of wisdom that you've got for the listeners there, Stephen? You've provided some brilliant insights already.
No, not really. I guess I would say I'm excited to see how the telecom industry starts to move more into Salesforce. I think that there's a definite big future there with how much overlap there is between BSS and CRM in general, and with the sheer flexibility of the platform. I would imagine starting to see a lot more OSS functions moving into their markets here.
Yeah, I'm definitely seeing that. So taking a bit of an interest in the vendor market, definitely starting to see more of the vendors, particularly the smaller vendors and the disruptive vendors coming in and using Force.com as a platform. So yeah, I'm intrigued to see how it goes. And I'm also intrigued to see how you're going to influence that through good growth heroes and the like. Thanks very, very much for being on the podcast today, Stephen. And I'm sure people will want to reach out and continue the conversation, maybe ask questions. Where can people find you?
Sure. I mean, they can reach out to the Growth Heroes Contact Us and get a hold of me there. I'd be happy to have a chat with anyone about Salesforce-based solutions, and we can talk, get in touch with Tim, the owner of the company. He's really good at kind of very quickly getting to the core of what a business is trying to do and how we could help. So,
yeah. And it sounds like the mid-market is mid-market telcos the ideal place with the monolithic OSS BSS that they've got, and the ability to put that Salesforce wrapper around it sounds like incredibly powerful.
Wrap the data, liberate it, and branch out from there, right? We can do that, and that's exciting stuff.
Brilliant. So thanks once again, Stephen, and also thank you very much for the listeners. I really appreciated your involvement.
Yeah, and thanks a lot, Ryan, for having me. It's been fun.
Thanks for listening to the Passionate About OSS podcast. You can find more episodes, more than 2,500 blogs, and our contact details over at passionateaboutoss.com.